This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Just want to do things my own way, you know.
Another night in another town, in another smoky place. Me and the band were sitting backstage, looking at the face of the lead singer from the opening act who had just left the stage. I saw youthful greatness in his eyes despite his age. He said, "Take a picture, why don't you? Many others have done the same. For I was once called Elvis Presley, but now Jackson is my name."
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast. Broadcasting from Trinidad World Recording Studios in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, USA. To all four corners of this bluish-green planet that we call our Earth. Coming to you in crystal-clear, high-definition audio, or something quite like it. How you doing, fans? Great to be with you here again. Phil Pritchett here. Of course. Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Delighted. Back in the swing of things, back with the podcast here. You're probably alarmed as you get that little indication there on your phone or on your computer. A new podcast, Phil? Oh, this must be the one he just did. This must be the one from last week where he's catching up with us after being gone for so long. Out of the loop for so long. No, my friends, no. This is me again here. Following up, I don't know, 10 days later or so. Podcasting away at breakneck speed, man. So much to look at here in the music world. Now, by the way, thanks for all the great feedback I got on the last week's podcast. Some of y'all posted on the page. Some of y'all sent me emails and texts and things. Phil@philpritchett.com, or you can post them right there on the podcast page. I read them all. Susan, David, Graff. All of you folks in there who post things, and the others who send me emails, and always appreciate the feedback. Thank you. It's good to know you're out there listening. Hope you're doing well. Man, I love this, the Jason Isbell story. Jason Isbell, the great singer-songwriter. I'll be honest, I don't know much of his stuff that well. His drive-by truckers stuff I knew. But he's been very acclaimed Americana singer songwriter. A lot of people in our genre, revere Jason Isbell. Out there touring a lot, always making records. He won a bunch of awards at the whatever it was, Americana Music Award thing, show, whatever. So anyways, he's been around. There was even a story from years ago in the Drive By Truckers. I can't remember if he was still in the band or not. They played one of the big festivals here in Fort Worth at Billy Bob's. And Drive-By Truckers is on the bill, and it might be one of the Ragweed Willie picnics or something up there. Anyway, I was home, where I always am during those events, apparently. But all of a sudden, yeah, my phone just starts blowing up with texts. Dude, you know, Drive-By Truckers calling you out, Drive-By Truckers calling you out. I was like, what? Yeah, and apparently, so I don't know if it was Isabel. I think it was still him using the band or one of those guys. But one of them had stumbled across Phil Pritchett and the Full Band, Fort Worth's favorite act. And from the stage said, "Hey, Fort Worth, Texas, the home of Phil Pritchett. All right, we're fans. Great to be here," something to that extent. So anyway, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the Drive-By Truckers. So anyway, I haven't followed Isabel's career much, but I'm always aware of him. I've always known he's been a very successful singer-songwriter, touring around. And evidently he retweeted an email he got from the show The Voice. Phil, what do you know about The Voice? Let me tell you what, man. I got kids. I got 5 kids here at the house. I know everything about The Voice, man. Oh, it gets shown. It gets followed. You know, really in the last year or so, not as much. But a couple of years ago, The Voice was on all night. Every time it was on, my teenage girls followed it pretty closely. Yeah, the little kids would sing and dance around. And it was something to watch. I mean, those shows are pretty wholesome, I would say. I mean, everyone's like, man, Phil, don't you hate The Voice, man? The commercialization of music. And I just kind of shrug. I'm like, man, I don't know. It's just stupid entertainment. I don't take it very seriously. But I've given my kids a lot of lectures about the pitfalls of The Voice and American Idol and things like that. Something along the lines of these shows only help the judges. They don't really help the contestants all that much. I think if you realize that as a contestant, then great. Go on there and sing your heart out. So anyway, evidently Isabel gets a notice from The Voice. And it just goes to show you, inviting him to audition, saying, well, you know, we've come across you out there on the internet, on the web, on the computer, or something like this. We think you got what it takes to maybe try out and make it on The Voice. And here's Isabel, you know, not a household name for sure, but, you know, no doubt making a good living and doing things his own way. I can't imagine what that felt like. That had to just strike him as hilarious. Just thinking. So he reposted it and made a lot of jokes about it. And pretty embarrassing for The Voice. But, you know, you'd expect nothing less from one of those types of shows that is so immersed in their own crap, just their own world of, you know, TV and, you know, whatever, the judges and traveling around. And what always gets me about these Voice shows is that it's just the acclaim that, you know, Adam Levine and Shelton and these guys, Shelton's not as bad as the other ones, that they heap upon these contestants is just, it's just comical. I mean, you got some little, you know, some young girl here, she sings pretty good. And, you know, Levine, rather than just saying like, hey, it sounded really great, you know, you sound good, and, you know, good luck with it out there. Really, really nice. I guess that's not, I don't know if they tell him to be more glowing, more gushing. I mean, he'll just say stuff like, your voice is just, you know, it really transforms everything that I've ever known about music. You are a star. All you need is a recording, and the entire world is going to at one time, all at once, realize you're genius. And I'm just on the couch going, is he? I mean, everybody's just cheering and the girl's crying. Thank you, Adam. I'm just like, and my kids are clapping. She's so great. And man, after a while, I'm just like, dude, this is terrible. They're like, what do you mean, Dad? I'm like, this is just garbage. What was he talking about? They said, we make stars in the show. This is what we're looking for. I'm like, who has ever changed the world because of The Voice? They get on there, they win. I mean, only if you're the winner. If you just win everything, okay, then maybe you can go play at the Windstar Casino for a few nights, which is great. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but then it's over, man. I mean, and so anyway, it's so full of its own self-importance and righteousness and arrogance, that it's just nauseating, you know? And I don't take it seriously. I like watching the kids sing and my kids watch it and we make jokes about stuff. And Shelton's pretty funny. He makes fun of Levine, and it's good. It's good entertainment. I mean, all these other shows are about, you know, vampires and people being chopped to bits and put in the trunks of cars. You know, there's not a lot of stuff you can watch with your kids in primetime television. So hey, on that level, I'm thankful for The Voice and American Idol or whatever. You know, it's good. Good family entertainment for all of us. But gosh, I just think those judges could lighten up, because what they say is going to carry a lot of weight with these young singers. And they just lay it on so thick, like if you're on my team, you know, we're just gonna transform the world of music. You're genius. I'm just like, she just sang a Beyonce song. What do you mean you're gonna transform the? And really, just 2 or 3 years later, you know, there's none of them out there. I don't know. Just no one remembers who won American Idol last year or the year before. Not that they should. It doesn't matter. But so when. When these judges talk like this, it just infuriates me on a certain level. So anyway, so Isabel gets this. I love that he gets this text that, you know, they could really make him a star. You know, hey, we think you've got what it takes. Well, the fact is, any of these voice contestants, if any one of them ever in history goes on to have a career like Jason Isabel's had, where they can actually tour the country and play at the House of Blues and get a few to several hundred people show up that know their songs and stuff, it'll be an astounding miracle. If that ever occurs for one of these contestants. Now, in American Idol, you've had Kelly Clarkson. What was she, season one? That was like 10 years ago or something. You've had her, I mean, and little else. I mean, come on. I mean, I can't even think of any of them. And I've watched the stupid shows from time to time. So keep on keeping on out there, Jason Isabel. And thanks for sharing the tweet from The Voice. That was I got a huge, huge kick out of that. You know, I had a connection at the X Factor. I'll be obscure about where it was from. And I kind of felt the same way. I felt funny about it because my contact contacted me very casually, but said, hey, I know somebody at the X Factor. And, you know, we can get you. You ought to come audition, man. Get out here to L.A. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, go to audition for the X Factor. And they go, what if you won? You know, the prize is, you know, whatever, this and that. I'm like, but what's the goal of being on the X Factor? So you can do music for a living, so you can sing and tour, I'm already doing that. I'm like, if I was going out to L.A. to, you know, sit in the lobby and wait to sing for these guys, and you know, I'd miss. You need 2 or 3 weeks out there to do that. You're in a hotel, you're spending money, you're missing shows here. I don't know. Maybe that's being short-sighted. Like, oh, Phil, but you're turning down the opportunity. I'm like, the opportunity to do what? Who's ever done anything on that show after winning, you know, and getting the balloons dropping from the ceiling? That's about it. You know, you can go open up for I don't know, you can go on the tour with the other people from the show or something, and that's it. And then meanwhile, you've pissed all your fans off and your family and everybody else. So count me out, dude. Me and Isabel, we're too old and we're too set in our ways, and we do too well in our own right. Thank goodness. Well, but it was worth a good laugh. What are you doing, Phil? What are you doing? As you know, man, I'm an old history major from college. I always loved history in high school. That was kind of my thing. And to this day, you know, I don't take the news at face value. I kind of look at the news, and when everyone gets all up in arms about this election or this, that, or, you know, Putin, the Russians are doing something. Wow, what's going on? And what you realize as a somewhat reader of history is you're kind of like, man, this is just how it goes. We've seen this. We've seen this thing before. You kind of look back. So I'm always reading about the times that have come before. And you realize that, man, there were lots of nasty elections. There were lots of wars. There were lots of battles. There were lots of all kinds of things all throughout human U.S. history. Forget human history and all the way back. I've often made the observation that these times people love to go on the news shows and, this is the most important election we've ever had, or this is the greatest issue ever, or this guy's the worst president the world has ever seen, ever, or what, or this is the best thing we ever, and just those statements are so overblown, and that's just casting all the great and notable times in history and pivotal moments aside for whatever we're dealing with at the moment, I think, which is ridiculous, if not detrimental. So I've always got a book on the coffee table, on the bedside table there in the bedroom. What am I reading now? Y'all heard me talk about, I think I did David McCullough's excellent book, Truman, the biography of Harry Truman that I read. Also 1776, not too far back, talking about the year that changed the Revolutionary War. Both David McCullough books. I'm a fan of his. He's a really great writer, easy to read, even though his books are like 1,000 pages long. So I'm plunged into the newest and biggest, one of the biggest David McCullough books, The Path Between the Seas. The Path Between the Seas. What are you talking about, Phil? I'm talking about the subtitle of this book, The Creation of the Panama Canal, 1870 to 1914. Phil, why are you interested in that? What, big deal, whatever. You drive the ships through there. Let me tell you what, man, about the Panama Canal. I think there's a lot of lessons here in the construction of this waterway. What is it, some 30-something miles long? Down there on the Isthmus of Panama. This was first attempted By the French. The French at the time in the late 1800s, were considered the finest engineers on the planet. France was a leader in technology, engineering, everything from shovels to equipment to designing dams and bridges and all kinds of things. And the hero in this time was Ferdinand de Lesseps. Ferdinand de Lesseps. He who successfully planned and built the Suez Canal that goes through, right there where Egypt, Africa connects to the Middle East. The Suez Canal, which is a lot longer. So Lesseps and the French built the Suez Canal so you could cut through there rather than having to sail all the way around the tip of Africa. Same idea. So I forget what year they completed the Suez Canal, but mid-1800s, I believe. The Suez Canal was built through desert, straight, flat sand. So they started at one end, and they just plowed their way through there. And son of a gun, just one of the great marvels of modern human engineering. The Suez Canal, you can sail a ship now through a little channel and just cut right through from the Mediterranean Sea all the way to the other side of Africa. Boom, just like that. So, Ferdinand de Lesseps, he was an internationally known man, engineer, triumphant, and he declares that he has plans in the French government. They want to build a passage between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean rather than having to sail, from New York. If you wanted to sail to San Francisco, you just had to go all the way down, man, all the way down around the tip of South America. Tierra del Fuego, man, and come all the way back up the other side. Ah, man, had to take this, sail this boat to San Francisco or Los Angeles or somewhere. And that's how it went. That's how, that's the way the land was made. Well, de Lesseps gets the idea. The French says, hey, we're the only people on Earth who can do it. We're going to find a spot in the isthmus there to build a canal just like the Suez, and we'll just be able to cut right through. And so that was the plan, man. So that originally they were going to do it in Nicaragua, I believe. The United States was upset about this because they were scared about having a heavy French European influence, like the French controlling the canal. So the U.S. is keeping monitoring this process very closely. A lot of debate. A lot of people in the United States wanted to build their own canal through Nicaragua, which was going to be a lot longer canal. But there was a big lake. Nicaragua has a lot of lakes. And they said, man, we won't have to dig through much land. We could just kind of cut through the land. Then you're in a lake. Cut through a little bit of land. Then you're in another lake. And we go all the way through. So there are all kinds of plans, all kinds of stuff going on. Well, the French finally decide that they're going to go through the narrowest point. Panama, which is interesting. If you look at a map, the Panama Canal is actually east of Florida. It's kind of weird to think about. You're kind of like, no, it's just below Florida or to the west, but the isthmus curves way over. And the Panama Canal really actually almost runs north and south where it curves up right there. Look at a map. Check it out. Anyway, so the French start building this thing. They raise all this money in public stocks, and there's an offering, and the stock just, a public offering to raise money. The public's going nuts. France is throwing money at this deal. It's the greatest thing ever. De Lesseps, he's a hero. He can't fail. And they get over there to Panama, and their engineers are walking through the jungles down there. And the first thing that starts to happen is they start to realize, look, man, we dug the Suez Canal. There was nothing there. It was just desert. It was sand. You start digging in the, through the sand. It's the same way all the way to the sea. So they quickly realized that Panama is full of jungles and mountains and disease and people and insects and snakes and volcanoes, and so the guys out there laying the path start to come back a little disheartened by it, going, man, this is going to take a lot more maybe than we've bargained for. Now, there was a railroad that ran that pretty much ran the route of the Panama Canal. This is Panamanian Railroad or something like that. That went from because some trade would happen where a ship would stop at that railroad and they would carry things by freight from the Atlantic side to the Pacific side or vice versa. And that's how they would get goods across to the two ports on either side. So you kind of had this railroad. That was sort of the rough area. Like, it'll just kind of go through here. Well, these guys start mapping out this deal, and man, they start recruiting workers from the nearby islands in Barbados and Jamaica. These are a lot of the workers coming in. De Lesseps, he just has a parade for himself every few weeks in Panama. They all love him down there. He starts building hospitals and mansions and castles and all this stuff that he can be in, and all of his workers and everything, and they're digging the canal. And man, lo and behold, people, they start running into all kinds of problems. The biggest one is malaria, yellow fever. Men are just dying off by the hundreds. The estimates aren't even public record, but maybe into the thousands. French people, of course, all the islanders, people working who get yellow fever. It's very contagious, carried by mosquitoes. The hospitals were insufficient, and it's just a disaster. And so there starts to be a lot of bad press in France, like, hey, man, this, because you got De Lesseps going into the French, parliament or wherever, just going, everything's great, we're going to get through here, no problem, raise more money. And some other guys are coming back going, it's a death trap, man. People are dying out there. We can't get through the rock, and the jungle is thick, and the railroad's terrible, and the floods, and it's a disaster. We can't do it. There starts to be some American influence down there. There's some American teams that go down there to work. Some Americans that go down there hired to help run the shovels and things like that. And McCullough makes a very interesting observation in the book. He says that it started to become clear that the great French engineers, if things weren't going well, or if a piece of equipment malfunctioned or wouldn't work, or they would be looking at their plans and there was kind of a massive rocky mountain in their path that they didn't anticipate, they'd kind of throw up their hands and go back to the drawing board. And whereas the American guys, when they started getting down there, would just kind of shrug and put some duct tape on something in the engine and just fire it up and dynamite something. We'll just go a little bit more to the right. Big deal. Just keep plowing ahead. And they said early on there was some dissension in the ranks between the French workers and some of the American teams. Because the American guys, that's kind of where some of the term Yankee ingenuity came up. So they said, man, these guys were just half-assed. They just keep going, keep blowing stuff up. That there was a different way of working between the Americans and the French. And so this proceeds for some time, but man, the death, the disease, the disastrous engineering flaws keep coming into focus all the time. And the French public starts to lose faith in the project and lose faith in the great Ferdinand de Lesseps. And finally, the whole thing goes broke. They've only just begun kind of digging the trench, and they built a lot of buildings, but a lot of them are abandoned now. There's just big steam shovels out there, dredges just stuck in the mud, and it's over. The French are done. They cut their losses, they bury their dead, and they all go back to France. So, meanwhile, we got this guy in the United States. Maybe you've heard of him. Teddy Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt. Who got shot? Was it McKinley? Anyway, who was before Roosevelt? Garfield, McKinley, I get confused. They both got shot, I think. Roosevelt becomes president. Famous outdoorsman. Maybe one of the Roosevelts were probably the richest family in the United States. One of them. I've also read another McCullough book called Mornings on Horseback about the Roosevelt family. Growing up in New York, Theodore, a young asthmatic kind of kid, very sickly, but very, very extremely wealthy. They would just take like 2 month trips down the Nile. They would just go stay in Paris for a year. They just had these gigantic brownstone house on Park Avenue or in Manhattan. The Roosevelts just built New York City and had tremendous influence. A lot of his uncles and fathers were very involved in local politics. So this is the atmosphere that the young Theodore Roosevelt grew up in. But as a short and sickly child, at a young age, he really sought to distinguish himself as a leader, as a tough guy, and that kind of led to his reputation. He was always out hunting. He was always out, rabble-razzing around, military service with the Rough Riders and all this kind of thing. They said, man, he made himself into this adventure and everything. So anyway, but he becomes president right around at the end of the French dissolution of the Panama Canal. And Roosevelt starts looking at building either a canal in Nicaragua. That's what a lot of senators were talking about doing. The French blew it by doing it down there in Panama. It's a death zone. Let's do it. Let's go back to Nicaragua and build it through the lakes. That's the easier way. Well, they finally decide on, Roosevelt decides and convinces people that, look, man, we're going to go through, we're going to basically purchase the French, defunct French company. They have made some progress down there. They've got some equipment there we can use. They've already built some hospitals and buildings and barracks and things like that that would be of use to us. The railroad's kind of there. So that's how it gets going, man. And Roosevelt, the one big problem they have is it's all owned by Colombia. Panama was just a little section down there. It was owned by Colombia. And Roosevelt's having a hell of a time with the Colombian government. They're corrupt. They get back to him slow. They don't want the United States to have that much influence over the canal. They want to be able to have the final say on how everything's done. So this just pisses Roosevelt off as a great American elitist adventurer. He doesn't stand for this kind of talk. He becomes very impatient. So he finally huddles a few guys together, some of his operatives and people, and says, look, what if we didn't, what if Panama was its own country? And, we just had a treaty with them to build the canal and do whatever the hell we want. We don't have to deal with the Colombians. And lo and behold, man, see, guys, this is how revolutions are born back in the good old days. That's what they did, man. So the U.S. sends a couple of ships down there. They plant a couple of guys in the Colombian army, some of the Panamanian militia guys, and this big officer, I think his name was Huerta, comes over from Colombia he's on the railroad or something, he's making some kind of inspection visit, and he's negotiating around, and the U.S. has things in place to where they all the soldiers in a dramatic scene in one of the ports turn their guns and point it at Huerta and say, you're under arrest. And the Colombian general screams at him, just, you traitors, I don't do this. But sure enough, man, they lock the guy up. They declare Panama. Conveniently, the Roosevelt guys, they all got a flag in their back pocket of the new Republic of Panama. Hey, looky here. Look, we didn't know. They got a constitution written up, the whole thing. Sign the Constitution. Hoist the flag over the buildings. There's parades and fireworks in the streets. The first act of the Panamanian government is to sign a piece of paper that says the United States can build the canal in whatever way they see fit, and we'll help them any way we can. Oh! So anyway, that's kind of tough to read, man, because there's just a reality to some of that stuff. You can decry it. You can say that's terrible. How dare Roosevelt do that? That's so elitist. That's lawless. Blah, 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 blah. And it is, no doubt. Then on the other hand, you go, yeah, man, but we got the Panama Canal. It was a world-changing thing for ships and commerce to be able to go through there. It was a tremendous thing for the United States. An unbelievable success story, a feat of human engineering the world had never seen to that point, or even since, hardly. So it's difficult for me reading that those kind of measures were taken. Anyway, maybe I don't have to feel one way about it or the other, but that's the reality. So, and McCullough kind of just spells that out. Hey, here's how all this went down. So the dirt begins to fly under the Americans, not without disasters. You get some key innovations around that time. One is with Dr. Gorgas. He is the guy, one of the main front doctors who goes down there, and his theory is that mosquitoes spread a lot of disease. And up until then, people were like, oh, he's crazy. How does he know that? And he had done extensive studies on mosquitoes. And so as the U.S. team started going down there, he was very, very aggressive with fumigating jungles and where the men are working, bug repellent in hospitals where there was like any stagnant water laying around. The policies were like, look, you got to throw out your water and all this where mosquitoes breed. And sure enough, man, that kind of turned the tide that people were still sick and dying, but in far, 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 far less numbers. And people were more healthy and they got better food down there to the workers and were able to get things rolling. And then kind of the other thing that happened was the engineer John Stevens, famous American engineer, tough old guy. He wasn't like De Lesseps that would just ride in on a parade float once in a while. You know, Stevens was a American guy, later became somewhat disenchanted with the project as it really, really got going. But that's kind of another story. But he was instrumental in really getting things moving. He had his knee-high mud boots on. They said he was just out there chomping on a cigar, wading through the mud with the men, joking around, keeping everybody going, keeping spirits up. And that kind of leadership kind of came into it around then. So Stevens got down there, got things going and settled down, got the work moving. Gorgas got the mosquitoes under control. Roosevelt just walking around doing whatever the hell he wanted to. And that's it, man. That's how the sausage is made. That's how the Panama Canal gets built. Pretty amazing stuff. So what strikes me about it, man, is just, it had been exciting to be around back then, watching something like that get built. In 1969, landing on the moon, something like that. I don't know if it's quite akin to something like that, but a real feat the United States accomplishes on an engineering or technological level. I was trying to think, email me, phil@philpritchard.com. What's something like that comparable in the last 10, 20, 30 years? I mean, off the top of my head, I don't know. I don't know what would be up there with that, but food for thought. But back in the day, man, Roosevelt and all the boys down there, Path Between the Seas, David McCullough, the creation of the Panama Canal, just gives you an appreciation. They're like, oh, the Panama Canal, it's a little ditch they dug where you know, drive the ships through so you don't have to go around South America. Seems logical. Seems easy enough. We take it for granted now. But let me tell you what, history teaches us one thing. These things don't just happen. Someone doesn't just go down there with a shovel and dig it because they think it'd be a good idea. Just, you had to... I mean, people tried and failed, and thousands died, and mountains had to be moved, literally, for something like this to get pulled off, man. Just an astronomical feat of proportions unimagined. Can you imagine in 1890 this kind of work going on, in 1880, down there digging through the mud? Oh, yeah, we're just going to connect these two oceans. You know, they didn't even know, when they first got going, the French, they one of their concerns was, well... You know, we're starting on the Atlantic side, and by the time we get to the Pacific, the water's going to all rush in because it was common knowledge that the Pacific Ocean was like, you know, 300 feet higher than the Atlantic. It was then and only then they were like, no, look, there's just sea level and that's it. They're like, oh, I thought when we got to the Pacific, it was going to be higher up. Just no, it's not higher up. It just is. So there are a lot of little things like this. There's like, oh, shit, you know, move on. So it's a great age of innovation, of discovery, of people just going to the absolute limit, for better or for worse in some cases. But hard to argue about the benefits of the Panama Canal for the United States, by God, through the years. Amen. Well, that's all the time we have, folks, here today. For the P2 Podcast, love talking about Isabel and a little historical Panama Canal talk. Hope you enjoyed it as well. Hey, book the band. Phil Pritchett and the Full Band or the British are coming. Or come record at Trinidad World Recording. We got studios everywhere producing stuff. For Brandon, we talked about last week. Brandon Aguilar, Tahoma. Abby Peck is coming in, talking to other guys about doing projects all the time, including my own. So keep that in mind, folks. Shoot me an email, phil@philpritchett.com. post comments on the podcast page or shoot me an email. I always read them. Love getting your feedback. We'll see you next time on the podcast, folks. Take care of each other out there. Much tougher. Living in Tennessee.
God save the king. He said it's not as easy as it looks to live as royalty. God save the king. He said I never died. I was just tired of living in Tennessee.